Famed for her beloved novels, Charlotte Bronte has been known as well for her insular, tragic family life. There is a new biography out to mark the bicentennial of Charlotte Bronte's birth. It is entitled Charlotte Bronte, A Fiery Heart by Claire Harmon, that delves behind the image to reveal a life in which loss and heartache existed alongside rebellion and fierce ambition. Drawing on letters unavailable to previous biographers, Claire Harmon depicts Charlotte's inner life with almost novelistic intensity. She seizes on a crucial moment in the 1840s in Charlotte's adolescence that ignited her determination to reject poverty and obscurity. The name of the book is Charlotte Bronte, A Fiery Heart. Claire Harmon is the author. She's also the author of several biographies, including Jane's Fame, How Jane Austen Conquered the World, and we welcome her to the roundtable this morning. What brought you to want to look at this life of such a beloved novelist?
Well, because I love her too. I'm one of the fans. And she seemed to me as a, you know, I'm a writer of literary biography and a fan of the Brontes, and particularly of Charlotte. She seemed almost too large a subject to approach. But I was encouraged by the fact that there was a bicentenary coming up, because I thought that a lot of people would be interested in looking at her again. And I wanted to look at her not just as a reader of the novels, but as a biographer, and to do what I do with all my subjects, which is to go back to the manuscripts and back to the original records and just sit and think about, you know, what was going on there in terms of the real person, not just the writer. I mean, it's the writer I'd revered, till I began to do this book, and now I revere her more because I've investigated her life.
What was it about her that your initial thought was that this is a subject almost too big to tackle?
Well, because she has been in print ever since. I mean, when Jane Eyre was published in 1847, it's never been out of print. And, you know, that's unlike Jane Austen, for instance, who has been out of print since her death. I mean, the Brontes were almost immediately mythologized. Charlotte died in 1855, and her friend Elizabeth Gaskell was immediately on the case writing the first biography. And when that book came out in 1857, the story of, you know, the Bronte sisters, of Charlotte and Emily and Anne, and their tragic lives and their peculiar lives up in on the moors in Yorkshire, I mean, it immediately became very vivid to the public, and it started this sort of cult of the Brontes. And so, I mean, everybody has grown up with, you know, the Bronte story. And there have been a trillion books about the Brontes in various forms. But I must say the story was so impellingly told by Mrs. Gaskell in 1857 that it's got a sort of carapace around it. It's got such familiarity that I felt that there was also much to be done by looking at all the original evidence and just take it apart a bit. And again, as I say, trying to see the things that a Victorian biographer and subsequent people who followed Mrs. Gaskell wouldn't necessarily have been able to say or to see.
There was material that you had access to that other biographers have not had access to. There were letters unavailable to previous biographers. Talk to us a little bit about how you came across those letters and how they aided in your understanding of Charlotte Bronte.
Well, the thing with the letters is I'm the first person to write a book on Bronte since they were all completely edited by Margaret Smith. So that edition finished in 2004. And it brought to light, I mean, Smith's scholarship brought to light a lot of previously collected and untranscribed letters, and she put together material. So it's really Smith who did the scholarship for that. But I'm the first person to sort of go to that published source and to comment on them and to then go back. I mean, I've also gone back to as many of the original manuscripts of the letters as I can. And in the process, of course, you find other things. You find, bits of marginalia. I found in a book belonging to Charlotte Bronte, a picture which I'm convinced is a self-portrait, which people have turned the pages of that book many times, but nobody has previously recognized that as possibly, I think it's absolutely the case that it's a self-portrait. again, things like this photograph of Charlotte, said to be of Charlotte Bronte. I mean, I can now prove that it's actually of Ellen Nussey. And so there are things, if you just look at the stuff that's there, often material, you know, or suggestions can then occur to you. And I mean, I certainly don't go to, and I didn't go to the Bronte archives looking for sort of particularly different scandalous view of her. I mean, I wasn't, you know, kind of trying to find stuff. It's just that if you familiarise yourself with a body of archival material, and you have the time, which a biographer often does, you know, several years in which to sort of think about these things and go back to them, connections start to emerge, and it's fascinating. I mean, it's wonderful to be able to find things when you weren't expecting to find anything. I mean, I did think with the Bronte material being so well known to scholars and students that there wouldn't be, I wasn't expecting any sort of revelations. But I feel that I have found things, and also I've found my own view of her, which is a very personal take on this extraordinary and sad life.
Claire Harmon is our guest. Her new book is Charlotte Bronte, A Fiery Heart. The book is published by Knopf. In that take, in that very personal take that you just described, you get such a sense of her determination to reject poverty and obscurity that came from that sad life. What brought her to channel that, do you think, to her first attempts at a novel?
Yes, I mean, it's amazing that all four siblings, I mean, they were in an extraordinary household. It's a very isolated household, the parsonage at Haworth. But the four Bronte siblings had a very powerful sense very early on of their own literary and artistic ability. And each of them, and especially the girls, wanted to be artists and hated the fate that was closing in on them, you know, the fate of having to teach and to support themselves in low-grade, low-paying jobs and or get married. And none of the Bronte sisters, interestingly, showed any inclination or desire to get married for its own sake. I mean, they wanted to have passionate excitement, but they didn't. They weren't thinking, I'll wait around and find a husband. You know, that'll get me out of this fix of having to be supported. But Bronte, I mean, she had this massive desire not to have an ordinary, drudgy life. But she also, I mean, she knew because her siblings and she had grown up understanding each other's talents. I mean, they had a very ready home support group. No support from the outside world at all until she went to Brussels in, as, you know, 25-year-old. She was not a teenager at that point. And then this was a kind of last ditch to acquire some extra sort of qualifications before that she and her sister set up their own school. It's a kind of, they didn't want to work for other people. They hoped that they'd be able to kind of get by running their own school. But in the process of getting this extra French and German, she met and fell in love with a very charismatic teacher in Brussels. And I make that very central to my book, her relationship with Constantin Heger. But I certainly didn't think that it's the only thing in her evolution or her emergence as a writer. But it certainly was a very strong personal motivation to get something in print to show to him. I mean, I think she always, I mean, from a very young age, was expecting and hoping to be in print. But it just got more and more difficult, you know, as she got into her 20s, as the kind of doom of being a governess seemed to be rolling, you know, on top of her. It was really pivotal. I mean, not just for her intellectual development, but for her sort of private determination to get something, anything into print. It was, you know, really, and he was really pivotal with that.
You spoke a moment ago about Elizabeth Gaskell and writing in 1857, just 2 years after Charlotte Bronte's death. And her interest in, they were friends, and really wanting to get a sense of to set up her legacy.
Mm-hmm.
Was she also protecting her?
Was Gaskell protecting Bronte?
Yes.
Yes. She was, because Elizabeth Gaskell was a very astute and a woman who's more worldly than Charlotte Bronte. I mean, she wasn't excessively worldly, but she had much keener social sense. And once she started to investigate Bronte's life, this was, you know, just immediately after Charlotte had died, various things like the intensity of her feelings for Monsieur Heger came to light, which Mrs. Gaskell realized would not do the reputation of her subject any good. And she was very much, I mean, she very much admired Charlotte Bronte, and she loved her as a friend. Although they weren't, I mean, they were close friends, but they weren't really intimate friends, because Charlotte Bronte was socially quite, you know, gawky and hard to deal with in some ways. But Gaskell was very sympathetic to her upbringing and her life, and saw immense sort of narrative and anecdotal value in it, but didn't want the public to think that Bronte was some sort of over-sensual, over-passionate single woman, and certainly didn't want to suggest that there'd been any inappropriate liaison there with a married man. So she really underplayed that, talked about Monsieur Heger merely as a teacher, and did sort of narrate very fully the sort of privations of the Bronte sisters' life in Haworth, the oddness of their father, and the tragedies of their early death. So, you know, Gaskell lent everything that way towards a sort of tragic life, and tried to keep it all very, very respectable, I suppose, underneath all that.
In reading your book, you come out with an end line that her life was pretty respectable.
Oh, yes, it was, certainly. But, I mean, a Victorian audience would have been much more likely to condemn any sort of suggestion that she had strong feelings. I mean, obviously, her feelings were incredibly strong on almost every subject. She was somebody who had very little sort of sickness to her skin. She was very much affected by her self-consciousness, by ambition, by, you know, desire for things. And her feelings for Monsieur Heger were kind of fervid, because she just kind of homed in on him as a soulmate. But that sort of intensity is something that we today expect as a kind of sign of genius almost, and we're very indulgent towards those traits. But, you know, in 1857, that would have been quite hard to depict as anything other than a bit batty.
It is the bicentennial of the birth of Charlotte Bronte, and Claire Harmon is our guest this morning. Her new book is Charlotte Bronte, A Fiery Heart, published by Knopf. Talk about the relationship that she has. She falls hopelessly in love with her married professor while working at this girls' school in Brussels. How ultimately he treats her as nothing special to him at all, as you write. Mm. So how pivotal is that experience to her in her writing, not just of how similar it is to Jane Eyre, but also to her life and to her understanding of the world at large?
Well, I think it was a terrible sort of education in chagrin, I mean, in profound disappointment. She went on to make a similar type of error with the relationship she had with her publisher. I mean, she was sort of super intense, and it clearly caused her a lot of trouble. But the relationship with Heger, although, you know, you're saying quite rightly that he became very cold towards her, strategically so. You know, he wanted not to be embarrassed or implicated in anything with her once she'd left the school. But she lost the audience that she was hoping for. She was really thinking of him as her, like, sole primary reader. And then he ceased to read her letters. He ceased to answer letters and really cut her off. And so she turned to a totally different audience. But she was also, of course, trying to prove herself to him, even though he wasn't acknowledging it. So having books in print that drew a great deal on things that they'd done together. I mean, Rochester is very clearly a version of Monsieur Heger, and he's even more clearly put into her last book, Billette as Paul Emmanuel, a teacher in Brussels. And, you know, she was ladling into these books signs and signals to him that were really very, very blatant. I mean, it's kind of like a use of her years in Brussels that just went on and on. And she just went over and over those themes till the end of her life. Although she was out of touch with this man, she was sort of basically punishing him in some ways for not having kept their friendship going and given her what she wanted, which was this kind of soulmate relationship, which is exactly what Rochester describes with Jane, you know, when he says that it's as if he's got a string attached just under his heart and it's attached to her. And, you know, Rochester calls her over the miles. They have a sort of telepathic relationship. And that's really what Charlotte had been not just hoping for, it's what she thought she'd had. But then she was disabused of that. And I think that the pain of that and the feeling of being cheated, all that energy goes into these, you know, brilliantly negative works that she writes. I mean, Jane Eyre is a famous romance, but it's full of anger and it's full of you know, seethingness. And it's about equality and it's about sort of stringent moral feelings. You know, plus it's got this great love story and people love that book for many reasons. But it's, you know, when you reread it and you just see all that sort of fieriness in it, it's for me that comes from this kind of seething nature that she had that was underlying all those works.
And you do get the sense, and obviously there's much more to it than this, but that she was misreading the situation, misreading the relationship.
Yes, she was sort of overreading every little signal. But to be fair, I mean, Monsieur Heger, being a French person, she had no kind of context for his manners and his temperament and his volatility. She just was, you know, really impressed by him. Although he was, Catholic, he was French, he was married, he was a show-off. And, you know, he was used to kind of domineering classes of girls. And, you know, he clearly was sailing very near the wind on all these occasions with Charlotte Bronte and the other girls. He was always weeping over the sick beds of various girls, you know, kissing them and hugging them and giving them sweets. So it's not surprising that Charlotte Bronte had this very sort of non-touchy-feely upbringing, to put it mildly, in the parsonage with her peculiar father and her, you know, strange siblings, that she found this, like explosive in terms of affection and potential interest and this kind of electric force that she felt from Monsieur Heger, you know, from his sheer charisma and his incredible sort of odd dips of temper. I mean, he was either all over people being terribly sweet to them, or else he was shouting, she said, like an insane tomcat. I mean, she has some hilarious descriptions of him. So she wasn't necessarily hoodwinked. She was just massively affected, and she's like the perfect person to appreciate his intellect and his kind of performative personality.
With this 200th anniversary of her birth upon us, what do you think that it's important we take away of her legacy and of her work, the legacy of her work?
I think that because she's been popular and in print all these years, there is a tendency, as with all great classic novelists, not to really read everything that's in those books. And I do think her legacy is a great deal to do with a really kind of courageous truth-telling. I mean, Jane Eyre isn't just a character who tells the truth in a fiction. The author is also telling truths and powering that book with the most amazing speeches from Jane, some of which are very famous. You know, when she says, "I am no bird and no net ensnares me. I'm a free spirit with an independent will." I mean, she says those things which are on T-shirts, you know, in the Howard Parsonage gift shop, and they're in people's minds a lot. And, and when Jane as a child, you know, stands up, she's like any rebel slave. She stands up against the bullies at the school. But there's also, apart from the sort of famous things that Jane herself says in that novel, there's this current of wanting there to be true equality. And Jane actually says things which show that Charlotte Bronte herself felt that that equality wasn't a kind of political goal to be won. It was something that she felt existed in her, and she just needed everybody else to see it. And that's a very interesting point of view for a Victorian girl to be in, you know, that there is no question of her being as worth anybody as anybody else's. I mean, having the same sort of spirit and the same worthiness as anybody, and the fact that her condition and her circumstances were different was the problem and not her actual worth. And when I hear things like these, you know, contemporary tags and cosmetics, because I'm worth it, I think that would have meant so much and so very different a thing to Charlotte Bronte. And she truly believed that she and every other spirit was worth it, in inverted commas, not in a kind of facile commercial way, but in their inner being. And that's such a very important and, as I say, brave message to have been promulgating in her first novel and in her subsequent novels too. Shirley's full of the same spirit. And Villette is much darker, because when she wrote Villette, her siblings were dead by then, and there was a tragic peculiarity to Villette. But in no circumstances was Charlotte Bronte unwilling to really tell the truth at great personal expense. And that's, I think, her main legacy is this kind of stringent, rigid desire to get it right and to say something to her massive readership.
One of the things I love about the book is, as we wrap up our conversation, is that you certainly tell her story, and it is not exaggerated and is very real, but you don't also over normalize her either. It's still a weird story, isn't it?
It's a very weird story. They were very weird people. they didn't fit into society much at all. There's a kind of slightly, you know, autistic aspect to Emily Bronte and to Charlotte. I mean, they couldn't. They were the worst people to go to a dinner party with or to invite to a party of any sort, because, you know, they wouldn't talk. They wouldn't interact with people. On paper, of course, they produce these works which have spoken to millions of people, but in society, they were, you know, really hard to get and really hard to deal with, and actually quite aggressive, I think, socially, as a result of their, you know, very odd, nurture. So yes, I mean, she almost missed being published, and she and her siblings would have just carried on being very eccentric daughters of the parsonage. But because we've got the books, we see that there's so much else to these people, and their strangeness has been able to be brought into service of, you know, literature in the most extraordinary way. You know, there's three books, Jane Eyre, Wuthering Heights, and Agnes Grey, all written in the same room in the same year, in the same family. I mean, it's their pain and their weirdness has resulted in fabulous literature.
Well, the name of the book is Charlotte Bronte, A Fiery Heart. It is published by Knopf. Claire Harmon, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for sharing with us this morning.
Thank you.
Again, it's Charlotte Bronte, A Fiery Heart by Claire Harmon. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.